I want to welcome you to this 10th presentation in our ongoing Hugh W. Nibley Lecture Series, celebrating his 100th birthday. I'm Paul Hoskisson of the Neil A. Maxwell Institute, and we're glad that you're here. We hope that you'll enjoy this presentation. I know that I am looking forward to it very much. I usually like to ask, are there any relatives of Hugh Nibley in the audience tonight? Sons, daughters, grandchildren? I hope that you'll pick up some of our flyers out on the table outside of the door as you leave. In this regard, also, I'd like to announce next week's lecture, Wilfred Griggs, who will hopefully be soon returning from his annual excavation in Egypt in time to give his lecture next week. We'll be talking on Hugh Nibley as mentor. And Brother Griggs probably comes as close as anyone does in this world to have been been mentored by Hugh Nibley. Our speaker tonight is, I want to say it this way, because we don't always introduce our wonderful female colleagues this way. This is Frau Dr. Professor Marilyn Arnold. We're grateful that she's here. She's a retired English teacher from BYU. She was born in Ogden, Utah. She majored in journalism and English at BYU and went off to the University of Wisconsin-Madison to do her PhD in English. She came to BYU in 1969. She just handed me one of her many books, Sacred Hymns of the Book of Mormon. When you open it up, there are Book of Mormon texts set to music. Just randomly, page 21, Mosiah 11 through 18, and the hymn is called Abinadi, Abinadi. And in here, there's a little blurb, I need to quote some of this. She served as assistant to the president under Dallin H. Oaks and dean of graduate studies under Jeffrey R. Holland. She has retired and followed the advice of Brigham Young and taken up residence in St. George. We're delighted that she's come up here to speak to us, Professor Arnold.
Thank you. So Wilfred didn't come back. He owes me one, and we're having, he is going to come down to St. George to do our book festival down there because he owes me one. He's the one who twisted my arm into this assignment. It's a lecture, I guess. The title of it is Words, 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 Hugh Nibley on the Book of Mormon. It doesn't say words, words, words on your printed program, but that's my title. Flannery O'Connor, a Southern writer of no small reputation, was once asked how she saw her own work in relation to the writings of William Faulkner. She replied that no one wanted her horse and buggy stalled on the tracks the Dixie Limited was coming down. That describes my position today. If ever there was a Dixie Limited in Mormondom, it's Hugh Nibley. And here I am, sitting on the tracks. But I don't intend to stay here long, I can promise you. I remember hearing Ray Bradbury describe his experience in writing the screenplay for Melville's great novel, Moby Dick, joking that he hadn't been able to read the thing with any comprehension until he was 30. He found that to do the screenplay, he had to immerse himself completely in that very long book. He got up one morning, looked in the mirror, and said, "I am Herman Melville. Tonight, I can stand before you and say, I am Hugh Nibley. I have been buried in Hugh Nibley now for several months." It's one thing to read the Book of Mormon in 6 or 7 weeks, which I have done a few times. It's quite another to read virtually all of Hugh Nibley's multitudinous writings on the Book of Mormon in 9 or 10 weeks. I would have brought my pages and pages of notes along to impress you, but they were too heavy to carry. In any event, here I am, up from that lesser-known Dixie, lesser-known except in Utah. Having recently been educated by our man to the fact that the expression land of, whether it be land of Jerusalem or land of Zarahemla, can, by historical precedent, refer to both the city and the surrounding territory, I can in all honesty claim to be from the land of St. George, even though technically I live in Washington. And that last convoluted sentence, incidentally, would scarcely exceed some of Nibley's rhetorical exercises. And incidentally, he employs the word incidentally freely to introduce countless side excursions into anything semi-pertinent that comes to his mind. And believe me, if you know Nibley, you know that a great deal comes to his mind, regardless of his announced subject. Some of you are aware that I'm an English teacher. Well, all of you are now, because Paul said it, in spite of a couple of side excursions into the Smoot administration building. Those of you familiar with Shakespeare's Hamlet will have recognized my title allusion, although it doesn't, as I said, appear on the printed schedule. And those of you familiar with the writings and speakings of Hugh Nibley will recognize its appropriateness. Words, words, words. When that old blunderbuss Polonius approaches Hamlet and asks what he is reading, Hamlet, book in hand, replies, "Words, words, words." It's the same answer I would have given anyone who had asked me Polonius' questions in those months of inundation in Nibley's writings. It was glorious, and it was maddening. I fell utterly in love with him, and I wanted to shoot him. Some of you have been there. Hugh Nibley is not kind to English professors in his writing, nor is he kind to college professors in a good many other fields. But he has special disregard for English teachers. They rank right up there with sociologists and anthropologists. Much as he sometimes sneers at what he deems rhetorical flourishes in writing, scorning the mealy rhetoric of early 19th century romanticism, he is a man highly conscious of style. He deftly employs nearly every rhetorical device in the book. I confess that I adore him for his inconsistencies. It was Emerson, after all, one of my guys, who pronounced a foolish consistency to be the hobgoblin of little minds. For example, Nibley delivers one of his attacks on professorhood in the form of an ironic parable, scorching several academic fields in one fell swoop. Yes, I know that one fell swoop is a colloquialism and a cliche, both of which Nibley uses frequently and happily. I insert them here and elsewhere in his honor. He uses his little parable, as he calls it, as a device for explaining the new trend in Book of Mormon criticism practiced by up-to-date intellectuals in a variety of disciplines. I quote it because no paraphrase can do it justice. A young man once long ago claimed he had found a large diamond in his field as he was plowing. He put the stone on display to the public free of charge, and everyone took sides. A psychologist showed, by citing some famous case studies, that the young man was suffering from a well-known form of delusion. An historian showed that other men have also claimed to have found diamonds in the field and been deceived. A geologist proved that there were no diamonds in the area, but only quartz. The young man had been fooled by a quartz. When asked to inspect the stone itself, the geologist declined with a weary, tolerant smile and a kindly shake of the head. An English professor showed that the young man, in describing his stone, used the very same language that others had used in describing uncut diamonds. He was, therefore, simply speaking the common language of his time. This is my favorite. A sociologist showed that only 3 out of 177 florist assistants in 4 major cities believed the stone was genuine. So the sociologists get it worse than the English professor in that particular example. A clergyman wrote a book to show that it was not the young man, but someone else who had found the stone. It is only an indigent jeweler, that's hard to say, indigent jeweler named Snite, don't you love his names, who points out that the stone is available for examining, and the matter of its authenticity has nothing to do with all these speculative assessments. Guess who Snite is? No mystery there. Hugh Snite Nibley. When Nibley lines them all up, however, the historians are clearly superior to the biologists, the sociologists, and the oracles of the English department. Note the irony, which in Nibley is nearly always in the service of sarcasm, unless he is speaking of himself, and then it is in the service of mock humility or mock ignorance. He adds that even English majors should know that a poignant motif or idea does not have to come from Shakespeare to be valid. His specific reference here is to the land of no return motif found in Helaman 3, in the midst of admittedly jumbled, though effective, imagery. Imagery, I must remind him, is definitely an English major term, though we permit others to use it on occasion. Nibley admiringly and rightly praises the Book of Mormon as a colossal structure, a book that, if considered purely as fiction, is a performance without parallel. At the same time, he can't resist contrasting it with the clearly inferior corpus of American literature, my specialty. Note the list of pejorative participles, and I use, you know, the two P's, the alliteration in his honor and in his fashion, pejorative participles and other adjectives with which he characterizes the literature of my field. He delights in describing it as full of big, bumbling, rambling, brooding, preaching, mouthing books, spinning out a writer's personal, usually adolescent, reminiscences and impressions at great and unoriginal lengths. This is the literature I've given my life to, you understand. I myself stand convicted of being a writer of such books, 8 novels to date, and worse still, a memoir in the works. But as my tennis partner says, she doesn't get sore at a bad call, she gets even. I was tempted to call this lecture The Revenge of the English Professor, but I thought better of it. Despite his seeming disdain for English teachers and their subject matter, Nibley is well versed in classical literature and a good deal of British literature. He even cites Mark Twain on occasion, and this in his writings about the Book of Mormon. Very likely, however, he was not familiar with Twain's version of the Diaries of Adam and Eve, set mainly in the Garden of Eden. As Twain tells it, in Adam's voice, Adam's life changes markedly when Eve is introduced into the garden because talking is the thing she likes best and talking is the thing he likes least. Adam says it is quite a relief to him when she takes up with a snake and has someone else's ear to bend. Adam confesses that he doesn't dare ask her anything because she has such a rage for explaining. If anything defines Hugh Nibley for me, outside his convictions regarding the Book of Mormon and his impatience with our money and power-driven society, it is his rage for explaining. Those of you who have read very much of Hugh Nibley or heard very much of Hugh Nibley know what I mean. This is a man who is compelled by some inner demon or angel to tell all he knows if he can possibly get away with it, and he knows a great deal. He is simply overwhelming, and I am still panting. If you think I exaggerate, take a look at copies or transcripts of talks he delivered at the BYU Law School or the Alumni House or a couple of Sunstone symposia. There is no way that a person speaking at a normal rate of speed could deliver those in 50 minutes or an hour. Of course, Nibley didn't exactly speak at a normal rate of speed, but still I sense that his mind was going about 100 miles an hour. One of those talks runs to 58 printed pages. You've possibly heard of the book Men to Match My Mountains. Well, Nibley could have written of his lifelong journey of learning and his passion for sharing what he learned under the title Tongue to Match My Thoughts. We don't have that opus, but it would be an interesting one. Actually, Nibley and I see eye to eye on a lot of things. Our mutual hatred of war, of posturing, of showy intellectualism, of ostentatious wealth, of celebrity, of self-serving divisions into good guys and bad guys, to name a few of the subjects that fill his Book of Mormon volumes. And all these he speaks of endlessly, and I do mean endlessly, in his writings and speeches on the Book of Mormon, because that book teaches us the danger and folly of such things. Closer to home, but related to his descriptions of Nephite society gone awry, is the matter of BYU society. One of his favorite targets, you may remember, was the infamous campus dress code of yesteryear. He saw clearly the contradictions in our culture, and he didn't hesitate to point them out. I happened to be sitting on the stand behind him at commencement exercises one April or August when he offered the invocation. Some of you may remember this. His opening words in addressing the father, or informing him, I'm not sure what he was doing. Anyway, his opening words were, "We are gathered here today in the black robes of the false priesthood." I felt the shock waves that went through the audience. Myself, I confess I had to suppress a snicker. But the thing that wells Hugh Nibley to my mind and heart is our mutual love of the Book of Mormon. He alludes to it ironically as the book nobody wants, allowing us how the world acts as if the Book of Mormon were being forced upon it by its will. Then he adds an ironic comment that is pure Nibley. Only the practiced skill and single-minded determination of the learned has to date enabled them to escape the toils of a serious involvement with the Book of Mormon. He is never more eloquent or serious than when he is defending that book. When it comes to matters of his own faith, he writes with great feeling. Hear statements like this, for example, in the midst of his defense of the absolute truth and historical accuracy of the Jaredite account in the Book of Ether. Ether shows us human society divided into two groups, not the good and the bad as such, but those who have faith and those who have not. They live in totally different worlds, the one group in a real heaven, the other in a real hell. In no uncertain terms, we are shown just what kind of world the faithless make for themselves to live in. Shortly before this, he had written, "Those without faith live in a world of their own, which to them seems logical and final. They take the very unscientific stand that beyond the realm of their very own limited experience, nothing whatever exists." I think that's a great statement. And then, after quoting the Lord's assurances to Moroni that he gives men weakness that they may be humble, Nibley adds, "What man of the world or posturing PhD," and there's that alliteration again, "posturing PhD, is ever going to ask for weakness? The men of the world seek for the things of the world, the realities they know, and the greatest of these are power and gain." Anyway, this is also so much pure Nibley. I mention such things because an important aspect of my assignment is to discuss Hugh Nibley's use of language in his writings on the Book of Mormon. After pointing out that in the Book of Mormon, specifically in Ether, we read about things beyond the veil of other worlds than this, and of men who talk with Jesus Christ face to face in visions, he regrets that some of his intellectual friends are knocking themselves out to discredit it all. They, in fact, argue that the idea for Joseph Smith's first vision was first worked out by a committee in Nauvoo in 1843. That should be news to all of us. Then Nibley adds in a statement both clear and strong, and I notice ending in alliteration, "There is nothing like the story of the Jaredites to show us that the gospel is as timeless as it is true." As he amasses evidence in the world of the Jaredites to prove the Book of Ether authentic, Nibley borrows a trick from the English teacher's trade. He presents his mountains of evidence as a series of letters to an imaginary correspondent named Professor F. Perhaps the letter format gives Nibley a legitimate excuse for experimenting freely with language and style, though really, he needs no excuse. He would do it anyway. He even plies the good Professor F. with figures of speech, such as this one. As with the Lehi story, if this is fiction, it is fiction by one thoroughly familiar with a field of history that nobody in the world knew anything about in 1830. So if Ether is a forgery, where did its author get the solid knowledge necessary to do a job that could stand up to 5 minutes of investigation? I have merely skimmed the surface in these hasty letters, but if my skates are clumsy, the ice is never thin. If my skates are clumsy, the ice is never thin. He uses metaphor to make his point. Here and again at the end of the next and final letter to F. The Book of Ether, like 1 Nephi, rings the bell much too often to represent the marksmanship of a man shooting at random in the dark. So he loves to play with language, figures of speech. His writings are laced with these kinds of things, and they're always very, very apt. Some years ago, I inherited the small office in the Harold B. Lee Library that Hugh Nibley had just vacated. In the hurriedly emptied desk, I found a few handwritten 3x5 cards. They were obviously his, but I didn't try to track him down. They were a clue to his method of research and writing. It was the old method we learned in our freshman course on the research paper, and obviously it served him well. He had an amazing ability to weave bits and pieces from dozens and dozens of sources into a smooth discussion of a single topic. How on earth did he keep track of and organize these disparate pieces, which must have run into the thousands, into seamless, flowing narratives? In my mind's eye, I picture him at a desk surrounded by stacks of cards, typing away on an old Underwood or Royal typewriter. When we read Hugh Nibley, we're in the presence of genius. Just as we share a love of and gratitude for the Book of Mormon, Hugh Nibley and I share a fascination with language, with words in action. These kinds of things link us, no matter our differences. And yet we look at the Book of Mormon with different eyes. He sees the book in a broad context, historically and culturally. He sees it validated not only by the Spirit speaking to his soul, as it most certainly does, but by all he has learned through his study of ancient languages, literatures, cultures, artifacts, geography, history, documents, and manuscripts, and by his travels in the Old World and his reading of those rare and valuable scholars who have earned his respect. Nibley's most important contribution to Book of Mormon studies may well be in his examining this remarkable book and proving it indisputably on the world's terms, even though he himself needs no such proof. I, on the other hand, have examined the Book of Mormon almost exclusively in the isolated world it creates on the page. And I have long argued and still believe that anyone who can read and is willing to be guided by the Spirit can access and understand this book, as Moroni promised, and arrive at a new and deeper testimony of its truth with each reading. Mine is the more limited view, Nibley's the more expansive, actual world view. He has the knowledge and experience to broaden our understanding of the world of the Book of Mormon as an absolutely real world, based in political, religious, and social culture of old world desert and city from which it comes. In every detail, from desert winds and bows and arrows to sticks and oaths and shining stones, Nibley documents and verifies the Book of Mormon. He argues, and I'm sure he is right, that the test of an historical document lies not in the story it tells, but in the casual details that only an eyewitness can have seen. It is in such incidental and inconspicuous details that the Book of Mormon shines. It is the small details that expose a fraudulent work and prove a genuine one. After all, no perpetrator of a fraud, least of all, could, and then you have to note the alliteration that's coming up here. he uses it to enhance his sarcasm. Least of all could the fabulous forger, Joseph Smith, according to the critics, possibly invent all the myriad of tiny details that are woven into the Book of Mormon. Fabulous forger. No one could do that, not in Joseph Smith's day or any day since, really, and be right every single time. And all these little details, Nibley proves, are seated firmly in the everyday lives of ancient contemporaries of the Lehites and Jaredites. His point? It is absolutely ridiculous to think an uneducated farm boy, the alleged perpetrator of a fraud in the early 19th century, could have invented details that have only come to light in the mid-20th century. Nibley's mind is full of the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Lakish Papers, and many other documents and artifacts, and everything anyone else has said about them. He handily pours it all out on paper, drowning me in names I can't pronounce and documentation I can scarcely wade through. What's more, he has tracked down virtually every written criticism of the Book of Mormon from the beginning and soundly discredited it. This is a man who has no qualms about exhibiting his own thorough and impressive, even exhausting, scholarship. Yet, I remind you, this is also the man who joyfully takes pot shots at academia and those who inhabit it, especially those in tweed jackets with leather patches on the elbows. Any of you? I confess I had one of those once. But not because it was required, as he sometimes says. Sometimes Hugh Nibley's approach is so heavy with information and so encumbered with documentation that he wears me out. He forgets that some of his readers are only English teachers and labor under limitations foreign to him. I confess that I like Nibley best when he is explicating the Book of Mormon itself, when his touch is lighter, when he reduces the mountains of external evidence, informative though they are, and carries me with him into the language and the power of the book itself. We then explore the text together. And oh, this is a man who knows how to read a text closely when he wants to. At those times, he literally soars. Even then, however, he sometimes can't resist telling all he knows. Ah, the burden of knowing so much. Would that I carried such a burden. Professor F. of the Letters, a fictitious anthropologist in an Eastern university, turns up again in Nibley's second book on the Jaredites, where he becomes a player in Nibley's drama, patterned after Plato's famous dialogues. This fellow may be an anthropologist, but his library looks suspiciously like that of an English professor to me. all the classics there, all the literary classics. Naturally, Professor F. is a pretender to intelligence, and he is equipped with the tweed coat and pipe required by his profession and institution. The other players are the intelligent Professor Schwolst. Of course, he's a fictitious character. A rare breed with a name to match. And Mr. Blank, the self-effacing Nibley character. Nibley calls himself Mr. Blank here in this particular dialogue. Surely one key to Nibley's method is in the statement which he puts into the mouth of Professor Schwolst. The only way we can be sure a thing has been proved is by overproving it. And overprove Nibley does at times, maybe most times, especially in establishing that the Book of Ether fits the true epic form, that it is written in the best heroic manner and describes a real world. I am convinced, but then I already was convinced a long time ago. And Mark Twain remarked in his tongue-in-cheek assessment of the veracity of the Book of Mormon, I could not be more satisfied and at rest if the entire Whitmer family had testified. Four of the eight witnesses, you might remember, were Whitmers, and Twain talking about the Book of Mormon. Schwolst is obviously a device for giving Hugh Nibley another voice, supposedly an objective one, whereas Mr. Blank is just as obviously out to prove something. Schwolst can thus corroborate Blank's, that's Nibley's, arguments from a seemingly unbiased and well-informed point of view. To give Schwolst credibility, Nibley even has him occasionally amend Blank, on a minor detail, of course. At times, though, the burden of information Nibley carries ceases to be mere facts in his hands, but actually recreates a world I can see and touch. I rejoice when he describes events and people as though he were there and knows them personally. When that happens, he takes us into the world of the Book of Mormon in a new and fresh way, sharing incredible insights. Even some of the seemingly small details, such as those I alluded to earlier, take on new meaning and expand my appreciation for things I have simply passed over in my reading of the Book of Mormon. He explains things I wouldn't have noticed or understood if I hadn't read him. For example, he reminds us that there are virtually no domestic scenes in the Book of Ether. Rather, as in all true epics, every scene takes place either on the battlefield, in the court, or in the wilderness, where hunting and hiding play almost as conspicuous a part as fighting. One of the most interesting new insights for me was Nibley's explanation of the sworn verbal oath, which was absolutely binding in the ancient Arab world and in the Book of Mormon. In fact, it appears to represent the only honor to be had among murderers and thieves, whether they be Gadiantans or apostate Nephite commanders of Lamanite armies. As a child of our time, I had puzzled over the seeming naivete of Book of Mormon leaders who took captive enemies at their word and released them on the sworn promise that they would cease their hostilities. And I remember, too, that at one point Zarahemla refused to swear such an oath because he feared it could not be kept and his word would be broken. I'd always wondered why a scumbag like him would even think twice about breaking his word. As I have suggested, in his works on the Book of Mormon, Hugh Nibley gives new meaning to the term creative writing. It seems there is scarcely a form of written discourse he won't experiment with, and most of them are literary, though he might not own up to it. I have already spoken of his use of the parable, the epistolary form or letter form, and the Platonic dialogue or the drama. Well, there are more. For an old instructor magazine, March 1961, he even writes a little story in which he imagines Nephi as a boy in Jerusalem. Nephi, as Nibley portrays him, was a bright boy, but deservedly subject to extra disciplining because his mind had a tendency to wander in the classroom. This is how he describes Nephi and his eagerness to meet the arriving caravan of his uncle Ishmael. Once released from school, he raced down the winding narrow streets like a skillful quarterback carrying the ball, barely missing dirty children playing tag or King of the Mountain, servant girls with huge jugs of water, poor peasants peddling loads of firewood, donkeys burdened with dried fish from Galilee or cheese from Bethlehem. What Nibley is doing, of course, is recreating the world of Jerusalem as it very likely was 600 years before the birth of Christ. Hugh Nibley has other devices up his sleeve, too. In Lehi in the Desert, he frames his response to Book of Mormon detractors in the form of a little narrative describing a mock trial in which Lehi, the old patriarch, is put on the stand as a witness. On the court docket is the case of Joseph Smith versus the world. Smith has been accused, and I'm quoting here, Smith has been accused, and how, of fraudulent practices. And Lehi, that was his and how, not mine. And Lehi is a witness for the defense. He claims to have spent many decades in certain parts of the Near East, about 2,550 years ago. Is he telling the truth? In other words, is the record accurate in its representation of old world settings for events related in 1 Nephi? Nibley opens the scene with a disclaimer stating that we have never been very much interested in proving the Book of Mormon. I can't really buy that statement since he spends hundreds and hundreds of pages doing just that. But he adds an important qualifier. For us, its divine providence has always been an article of faith, and its historical aspects by far the least important thing about it. In this same chapter of Lehi in the Desert, one of many in which Nibley goes after Book of Mormon debunkers, he pretends a playful ignorance. It was all too easy for the present author, quoting, lacking the unfair advantage of either wit or learning, to show where Mrs. Brody, in composing a history of events about 100 years old, contradicted herself again and again. He always calls her Mrs. Brody, and you can feel the emphasis on the Mrs. as he attacks her thinking. This is ironic modesty in him, of course, followed by the poisoned dart, pure Nibley. In the service of humor, he also wants to assure his audience that even he has had his blind spots. Let one example serve here, this for the entertainment of his fellow high priests in the manual and approach to the Book of Mormon. Years ago, the author of these lessons in the ignorance of youth wrote a doctoral dissertation on the religious background and origin of the Roman games. He has developed this theme through the years in a number of articles and papers read to yawning societies. All of us in the academic world can relate to yawning societies. And all the time, it never occurred to him for a moment that the subject had any bearing whatsoever on the Book of Mormon. But back to the trial narrative, where Nibley imagines Lehi on the witness stand. Nibley points out that generations of shrewd and determined prosecutors have failed to shake Lehi's testimony or catch him contradicting himself. Moreover, behold, out of the east come new witnesses, a host of sunburned explorers returned from Lehi's deserts to tell us what life there is like. And all of them, ancient poets of the Arabs, crates and crates of exhibits A to Z, seals, inscriptions, letters, artifacts from Lehi's own homeland, confirm Lehi's account. In the light of all this new evidence, Nibley says, the defense asks that the case be reopened. I'm with him. He then goes on for a page and a half with a volley of short, rapid-fire questions the prosecution uses in cross-examining Lehi and the newfound witnesses. These, Nibley says, are only some of the well over 100 possibilities he has uncovered, most of them such questions as no one on earth could have answered correctly 120 years ago. Then he asks and answers the anticipated rhetorical question, but haven't we been decidedly partial in dealing with Lehi? Of course we have. We are the counsel for the defense, he says. In 1964, Hugh Nibley updated his 1957 manual for Melchizedek priesthood lessons titled An Approach to the Book of Mormon. I have to say that Nibley's choice of subject matter for a Sunday morning priesthood course would have surprised me if an approach to the Book of Mormon had been the first of his writings on the Book of Mormon I had ever read or reread. His rage for explaining is evident here too. And true to form, many of the lessons are less about the Book of Mormon itself than about how the book fits into its larger context, ancient Jerusalem and the Arabian desert, setting, governance, inhabitants, culture, challenges, habits, and so on. Thus, the book becomes a highly selective approach to the Book of Mormon, with no intent to be a commentary on sacred text itself. It is learned, it is crammed with pages and pages of facts, and it can be difficult to digest. In my mind's eye, I picture a class of high priests in Kushurim nodding off while a struggling teacher faithfully tries to present volumes of material he himself cannot fathom. And some of these lessons go on for 28, 30 pages. And we cringe at five or six, don't we, when we teach. For example, in just five pages of the second lesson, this is the second one that high priest teacher is going to encounter. In five pages in this lesson, we get references to the plates of Darius, the Jewish colony at Elephantine, the palace of, which I can't really pronounce, Ashurnasirpal, Sumerian Umma, King Numan of Hira, Eusebius, the Bertes Valley, the Orphic Mysteries, places called Thurii, Sippar, and Asher, the groves of Persephone, Plato's description of Minos, the Isles of the Blessed, Tartarus, the Demotic Chronicle of Egypt, Kalawan Copper Plate, the Taxila Silver Scroll, the Qumran Cave, the Sanskrit writing of India, the Phoenician alphabet, Sumatra, the Hittites, the Karen Plate, the Ugaritic Library, the cuneiform tablets, Ahijah the Shilonite, and the Cassia Plate. That's most of these. I've seen some of them in print, but I've never heard most of them. I've never heard pronounced. And some of them, I confess, you know, I have a huge unabridged dictionary. Some of them aren't even in that, so I couldn't find out how to pronounce them. And this, as I said, this is in the priesthood manual. I concede too, though, that as the final lessons move more solidly into the Book of Mormon itself, they become more accessible to average, that is, normal folks. But Hugh Nibley has to tell us what he knows, and what he knows is ancient history. Nonetheless, at times he can be downright mesmerizing and even understandable, especially for a reader sensitive to the way he works with words and sentences. This is not a man interested in facts and ideas alone. As I have suggested, this is a man who loves writing for its own sake, a man emotionally involved in his subject, and a man with the rhetorical gifts to do his subject justice. I could cite countless examples, but let's look at just one small section from Lesson 3 in the Priesthood Manual. Nibley is speaking of the astoundingly cosmopolitan world in which Lehi lived, and I think his high priest would understand this perfectly. It was an unsettled age of big ideas and big projects, a time of individual enterprise and great private fortunes flourishing precariously under the protection of great rival world powers, everlastingly intriguing and competing for markets and bases. A strange, tense, exciting, and very brief moment of history when everything was big with the future. No other moment of history was so favorable for the transplanting of civilization, so heavily burdened with the heritage of the past, or so rich in promise. For a brief moment, the world was wide open. There was nothing on the political or economic horizon to indicate that the peace and prosperity achieved by the shrewd and experienced leaders of Egypt and Babylon could not be permanent, or that the undreamed-of riches that were being amassed on all sides actually represented the burst and glitter of a rocket that would in an instant vanish into utter darkness. Isn't that gorgeous? Beautifully written, but a bit frightening, isn't it? Change the name of the countries and move into the 21st century, and we see history repeating itself. And remember, Nibley wrote those words more than 50 years ago. One of my favorite lessons in the manual is the chapter that paints a portrait of Laban. That's the title of the chapter. Nibley insists that everything about him is authentic, that he epitomizes the seamy side of the world of 600 BC, and that Nephi resurrects the pompous Laban with photographic perfection, as only one who actually knew the man could have done. Then Nibley goes on to enhance Nephi's description with a string of adjectives that few English teachers could top. Laban, he says, and this is quoting, was a large man, short-tempered, crafty, and dangerous, and to the bargain, cruel, greedy, unscrupulous, weak, vainglorious, and given to drink. Later, with mock admiration, Nibley concedes, in all fairness, that Laban was a successful man by the standards of his decadent society. He was not an unqualified villain by any means. Furthermore, he was shrewd and quick, not a man to be intimidated, outsmarted, worn down, or trifled with. Then Nibley adds the punchline. He was every inch an executive. The high priest in Kushirim would love that last line. Nibley had no kind words for people he regarded as wealthy power mongers. In one of the lessons, Nibley takes the opportunity to discuss what he calls the way of the intellectuals, those for whom the search for knowledge is only a pretext, indicating that Lehi's people inherited a tradition of intellectual arrogance from their forebears. Nibley goes on to list and discuss the intellectuals of the Book of Mormon: Sherem, Nehor, Amlici, Korihor, Gadianton. Against them he sets the great Alma, who started out as one of their stripe. It took an angel to convert him, Nibley says, yet he was made of the right stuff. Maybe Nibley uses slang expressions, colloquialisms, modern phrases, and the like, at least partly because he does not want to be taken for one of those intellectuals who pretend to more knowledge and ability than they have. If Hugh Nibley sometimes buries us in his scholarship, perhaps it's because in his enthusiasm for his subject, he forgets that Mormons are his principal audience. Much of the time, we are his only audience. Like, unfortunately, like his lessons in the priesthood manual and his series in the Improvement Era, Nibley's writings and talks vindicating the sacred record are rarely delivered to the external world. Perhaps some of them should have been delivered to that world as well as to us. Many of you have heard Hugh Nibley speak. I am reminded of a comment James Russell Lowell made about Ralph Waldo Emerson's lectures. He said something like this: we do not go to hear what Emerson says, we go to hear Emerson. In his discourse, that is, Emerson could be difficult, if not impossible, to follow, but he was nonetheless spellbinding. Nibley's addresses at the BYU Law School, the Alumni House, and two Sunstone Symposia are cases in point. I mentioned their length earlier, but said little about his method in those settings. In speaking, somebody interrupt me with a question. Anyway, in speaking at Sunstone Symposia, Nibley adopts a no-holds-barred form of rhetoric. Modernisms abound in both addresses. Twice he describes the iniquities that permeated Nephite society prior to the cataclysm as a rich mixture of our primetime TV. Moreover, and he uses all these modern terms. Moreover, organized crime runs rampant when Kishkumen hires Gadianton, a fast-talking professional hitman, to organize his mafia. Nibley observes that when business booms, people are corrupted. The prosperity in the time of Good King Mosiah produced a spoiled generation of smart alecks. And while Alma's people later became an ideal community, the rest of the society went to an assortment of immoral and criminal activity. In fact, they offered all the excitement of a highly competitive society, a night of primetime TV. And I suspect that 1988 primetime TV was pretty mild by comparison to 2010 primetime. Was that the era of Dallas? And yeah, that's probably where some of that came from. And throughout his writings, Nibley occasionally proceeds by asking questions which he then answers. Some of his questions are rhetorical, with the answer implied in the question. In the 1981 law school address, however, Nibley adopts the question and answer format for nearly the entire speech. He sets up a straw man as questioner, raising points Nibley wishes to address. That goes on for 45 pages. After that, he's not done yet. After that, he shifts to comparative notes on ancient Mesoamerica. He titles the speech Free Men and King Men in the Book of Mormon. That is an apt title, yes, but the speech could just as accurately have been called Lessons from the Book of Mormon for Our Day and Especially for Aspiring Attorneys. Nibley has the pulpit and he uses it to good advantage. Predictably, the address is laced with platitudes and themes which he deems especially appropriate for law students. Actually, he begins this speech rather matter-of-factly, almost harmlessly, never completely harmless, for him, but in time he warms to his subject and really heats things up. I picture his audience squirming as he lectures to them from the Book of Alma, his weapon of choice on this occasion for teaching what I have come to call the Nibley Doctrine. At the heart of this doctrine is the injunction to free ourselves from worldliness and the inequality it breeds. Repeatedly, Nibley demonstrates a central Book of Mormon teaching that peace and harmony abound only when people adopt and promote the principle of equality of goods, positions, and opportunity. Nibley says that the danger lies not in riches as such, but in the unequal distribution of them, which he calls an abomination to God. He sneers at careerism and the game of status and prestige, and asserts in one of his hundreds of quotable quotes that where wealth guarantees respectability, principles melt away. I suspect the ROTC knew better than to invite the pacifistic Hugh Nibley to speak to their students, even though he sees Captain Moroni as a model, as the ideal for all military personnel. He notes in addressing a Sunstone symposium in 1988 that Moroni has been wrongfully held up as a model of military macho to LDS youths. For models, Nibley would give us, as he does the law students, men who chose to teach the gospel of Jesus Christ to their enemies rather than fight them. Men like Ammon and his brothers, and Alma, who knew that the gospel was the only solution. They absorbed abuse without retaliating and touched hearts by serving and teaching. And then there were the converted people of Ammon, who buried their swords and chose to be slaughtered themselves rather than to slay another human being. Captain Moroni, Nibley reminds us, was a man who hated war and bloodshed. He averted it whenever and wherever he could. And when he couldn't, his wars were all defensive, never preemptive. For Moroni, peace and freedom, and I'm quoting here, peace and freedom were as inseparable from each other as both were from equality, which Nibley calls Moroni's grand passion, a positive mania with him. Nibley points out, too, that some of the most valiant warriors and seasoned fighters were very conspicuous pacifists and war objectors in the Book of Mormon. I can hear the regret in his voice and the grateful sighs in his audience as he concedes that we cannot go into their stories here. Since equality, freedom, and peace, inseparable in Nibley's mind, were his grand passions too, one wonders if he came to these great notions through his reading of the Book of Mormon, or if he found in that book confirmation of already deeply held beliefs. Moroni, whom Nibley describes as the greatest champion of equality, loved peace, and he knew peace and freedom could be gained and maintained only through equality. Nibley insists repeatedly that the Book of Mormon teaches this principle: without equality, there can be no freedom. It is the king men in the Book of Mormon who love war, he says, and the free men who hate it. In typical Nibley fashion, he injects phrases from the modern era. King Man Amalekai, in the true spirit of the post-war boom, made masterful use of the media as he saturated the airwaves with his propaganda. Does any of this sound familiar? Nibley really loads the language when addressing the law school. Just as he had done in the priesthood manual, he talks of how the Gadiantans took over the legal system in Nephite society, gaining complete control of the law courts and doing whatever they pleased under the color of legality. He gets very specific with these law students. Contending that wealth corrupts with great speed, he allows us how at once the happy recipient of a big promotion is expected to change his lifestyle, I'm quoting, move to a better part of town, join different clubs, send his children to different schools, even change his church affiliation for a more fashionable one. A warning, surely, to his young audience, whom he clearly deems to be committed to education for success. By the way, in the priesthood manual, no less, Nibley speaks of the Gadianton Protective Association, which soon became the biggest business in America. Sly dog, he capitalizes the three initial letters, giving us GPA. We all know what GPA is and what he thinks of it. Later in the same lesson, he calls up the reference again, taking specific aim at the legal trade. He speaks of judges who happen to be card-holding members of the Protective Association. And in a similar vein, remember the hapless professor and Nibley's platonic dialogue? There and in previous fictional correspondence, he is dubbed Professor F, or simply F. With his obvious limitations, the poor fellow could not have been Professor A, B, or even C. He has to be F. The business of grades was obviously on Nibley's mind in his address to the BYU alumni people, too. He reports that in the preceding week, students who enrolled in his religion classes had just one question to ask: how do we get grades? Listen to his take on the matter of grades. Grades are acquisitive, competitive, and phony. But they are the official legal certificates that everyone must have, issued in fixed denominations on a mathematically graduated scale, to be converted, it is hoped hereafter, into legal tender of the land. And then this statement: this is no trifling thing. The seeds of such corruption are all pervasive. Nibley, he never misses words, does he? And while he is at it, he hits the dress code again, declaring that the mechanical legalistic smoothness of it, and he's borrowing a term here from Solzhenitsyn, the mechanical legalistic smoothness of it is nowhere more evident in evidence than here in our midst, where for years short skirts were modest and long slacks immodest, because the rule said so. Mustaches and beards, mandatory among our grandfathers, became by decree carnal, sensual, and devilish. But back to the law school address. On the subject of the pursuit of worldly success, Nibley is relentless. He describes some of the king men as a self-styled aristocracy, social climbers lifted up in their hearts by their new wealth, haughty and aspiring judges, power-hungry local officials, including almost all the lawyers and the high priests, men taking advantage of church positions. But for the free men are a very different story. Unlike the key men, king men, and notice we'll quote him again here, these free men made war with heavy reluctance and without rancor. They were peace-loving, non-competitive, and friendly, appealing to the power of the word above that of the sword. They were quick to spare and forgive. They were not class-conscious, but prized equality among the greatest of blessings. In their personal lives, they placed no great value on the accumulation of wealth and abhorred displays of status and prestige, the wearing of fashionable and expensive clothes. Eschewing ambition, they were not desirous or envious of power and authority. They sought the solution to all their problems in fervid prayer and repentance. Nibley's fictitious questioner is not convinced. It sounds rather boring to me, too idealistic and unrealistic, he or she says. Nibley answers that it seems that way to us because we have disqualified ourselves for that kind of life. Nothing short of a fix moves our jaded and overstimulated appetites anymore. And this, we remember, was 1981, nearly three decades ago. Imagine the rhetoric with which he would characterize and blast our society today. Even as he warns law students against the speedy and corrupting power of wealth and the deceitfulness of self-image, Nibley can't resist sarcastically crediting the Zoramites with unswerving adherence to proper dress standards. So the Zoramites, they knew how to dress. They dressed according to standards. So again, the contradiction in the old BYU dress code takes a hit. He reminds us, too, that at one point Nephi asked the Lord for an horrendous famine to stop the people from plummeting to destruction. So finally, Nibley says, I'm quoting him again, the people were willing to give up their stocks and bonds and settle for just their lives. By the way, he talks about, you know, the treasures that disappear. He compares that to money one puts in the stock market. And again, here we are today, same kind of situation. Hugh Nibley's message to those gathered at the BYU Alumni House in September 1981 is tailored to them as pointedly as is his message to the law school. 1981 was a very good year for promoting the Nibley doctrine by way of the Book of Mormon. I won't go into detail here, but I can sense his emotion as he now declares the Book of Mormon to have one dominant theme: the polarizing syndrome. And by the way, his themes, his major themes, can shift according to his audiences. He defines this polarization as drawing lines and separating into sides, into the so-called good guys and bad guys. And he declares that the Book of Mormon teaches such divisions to be oversimplifications and often wrong. Furthermore, he reminds us that many times a good share of the Nephites become bad guys while many Lamanites become good guys. I recall that in Helaman, the converted Lamanites won't tolerate the criminal Gadiantans while the Nephites embrace them. In language conspicuously aimed at enthusiastic, rabid that is, alumni fans, Nibley derides competitions designed to eliminate opponents until we prove who is numero uno. Moroni, Nibley says, uses the dismal tale of the Jaredites to illustrate the utter insanity of the polarizing mania that destroyed his own people. In jockeying for the number one spot, people are killed right and left, and finally a whole civilization is wiped out. As the world polarizes, and quoting, as the world polarizes around overrated individuals, we see that only Shiz and Cory Annemar are left. And then only Cory Annemar remains, all alone, the undisputed number one. Pristine Nibley irony. That's one way to be number one, is kill everybody else off. Nibley's lengthy discussion of the dangers of polarization, which destroyed Nephites, Jaredites, and Romans alike, is clearly issued as a warning to us. We too, he implies, are champions of one package loyalty. And that's quoted. And participants in a government and society bent on widening the gulf between ourselves and the currently identified opponent or enemy. Nibley calls it planned polarization and declares that it is fabricated by the power seekers. You might remember that Nibley attacked Richard Nixon ruthlessly in that particular speech. He pricks our collective conscience with President Spencer W. Kimball's great bicentennial address. In that address, President Kimball spoke of our unfortunate dependence on every kind of military weapon and fortification to deliver us from the enemy, and added, "When threatened, we become anti-enemy instead of pro-kingdom of God. We must leave off worship of modern-day idols and a reliance on the arm of flesh." Nibley turns to the evil of polarization again in his 1988 Sunstone address, making his point with heavy irony. War settles everything by a neat polarization, everything evil on one side and everything good on the other. No problem remains for anybody on either side but to kill the people on the other side. That's Nibley, I'm quoting. In Since Cumorah, Nibley devotes an entire chapter to the problem of polarization. He titles it Good People, Bad People, and delivers this stunning insight. The Book of Mormon offers striking illustrations of the psychological principle that impatience with the wickedness of others, even when it is real wickedness and not merely imagined, is a sure measure of one's own wickedness. Isn't that an interesting thought? Principle: impatience with the wickedness of others, even when it's real, is a sure measure of one's own wickedness. We need to think about that. The second edition of this volume was published in 1981, the same year as the Alumni House and the Law School Lectures. Perhaps this struck him with new importance as he was revisiting Since Cumorah. Whether it is Satan or a mortal foe, Nibley asserts, nothing is more crippling to creative thinking than obsession with an enemy. There's another one to think about. Pause on that statement a moment. Nothing is more crippling to creative thinking than obsession with an enemy. Nibley goes on, the person who can think of only one solution to a given problem is mentally bankrupt. The person who can think of only one solution to every problem is doomed. He reminds us that there is no mention in the Book of Mormon of God's being an enemy to the devil or of fighting against him. The only invitation, he says, to God's followers is to love God and to serve him by doing good continually. No need to refight the war in heaven, I guess. As he works toward the end of the alumni address, and I work toward the end of this presentation, Nibley brings his discussion even closer to home. He sees LDS people in Utah associating one political party with the way of light and the other with the way of darkness. The logic of that polarization leads one to conclude that since there are only two sides, one totally evil and the other absolutely good, and I am not totally evil, I must be on God's side, and that puts you on the other side. Like the Book of Mormon, Nibley's words seem to apply to almost any age, including ours today. Food for thought, indeed. There are many things about Hugh Nibley that simply amaze me, and none more than his eloquence. As I have said, he is a man who knows how to use language to accomplish his purposes, and his purposes, like those of the writers and editors of the Book of Mormon, have much to do with us. Let me share a few of his more quotable quotes and irresistible phrases with you. One, admission of ignorance is really no substitute for knowledge. Another, none may commit his decision to the judgment of a faction, a party, a leader, or a nation. None can delegate his free agency to another. Another one, only those who are aware of their lost and fallen state can take the mission of the Savior seriously. Another. This one is especially good. The devil does not care who is fighting or why, as long as there is fighting. The moral is that wherever there is a battle, both sides are guilty. Another one. To discover that one is nothing is the first step to breaking loose. Another. God has given us our gifts and talents to be placed freely at the disposal of our fellow men, and not as a means of placing our fellow men at our disposal. Another, the only place we can confront evil and overcome it is in our own hearts. Hugh Nibley is not just informing us. He is chastising us and calling us to repentance. His writings on the Book of Mormon confirm that he became something of a self-appointed conscience for the people of the last dispensation, in the same way that Socrates has been spoken of as the gadfly of Athens. In personality as well as lifestyle, it would seem that Nibley resembles Socrates, whose concern for right conduct and whose ready wit and ironic pretense of ignorance were legendary. And if our fellow countrymen can plead ignorance and go their merry way in pursuit of pleasure, wealth, status, and power, we who have the Book of Mormon, and with it prophets and the restored gospel of Jesus Christ, cannot plead ignorance or go our merry way. Nibley is dead serious about this, and it may well be the central message of all his writings on the Book of Mormon. Hugh Nibley is the Book of Mormon's impassioned defender, and as such, he is also the gospel's impassioned defender. Moreover, like the prophets he revered, he lived what he taught, and he feared for us. The whole corpus of his Book of Mormon writings is his testimony, but let me conclude with three short statements. In the first, he says, in effect, that any mortal writings, including his own, pale in comparison with the ancient record given to us. Quoting, nothing can do justice to the power and impact of the Book of Mormon account itself. And still there are those who maintain that a flippant and ignorant youth, so regarded, of 23, composed this vast and intricate history, this deep and searching epic of the past, this chastening and sobering tract on the ways of the wicked. The second is simple and to the point. As I have said, Nibley could construct highly complex sentences, but he also knew the power of the short declarative sentence. The whole force and meaning of the Book of Mormon, he says, rests on one proposition, that it is true. It was written and published to be believed. Then he says it again. It was written to be believed. Its one and only merit is truth. I know, just as Hugh Nibley knows, with my whole heart and soul, that the book is true. That mutual conviction binds us in a very lovely way, and I am grateful for it. The last example I will cite is a statement that has also become a lasting truth for me. It explains my decision to take an early retirement and flee, like Lehi's family and others in generations that preceded and succeeded him, to the desert. For this one statement, I can forgive Hugh Nibley everything. In the desert, we lose ourselves to find ourselves.